as I say hello. Reach up to the sky, way up high, easing out nice and slow.
Well, if this is going to be a generally apologetic Christian podcast, you know, my thought was to let's just go ahead and handle all the issues. Some as they come up, but some issues just seem to never go away. And abortion is one of those issues. It's an issue that Christians need to understand. We hear an awful lot about it in the news, especially these days, as videos from Planned Parenthood just come, well, I guess actually not from Planned Parenthood, from a group trying to get to the bottom of Planned Parenthood. But as those things leak out, it certainly seems that there is an increased interest in abortion. Exactly what it is, what is the right thing to do in difficult situations, and so on and so forth. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. I am Evan McClanahan. This is the Sin Boldly podcast, recorded right here in KPFT Studios, 90.1 FM in Houston, Texas. Big thank you to KPFT for allowing this podcast to get out. If you want to contact me about this episode or anything else, you can do so by emailing me at the church email address, which is emc2@felchouston.org. And that's, of course, the church website as well. The website for KPFT, if I didn't already give it, is kpft.org. You can go there to find out more about their diversity of programming and, of course, to make a donation because KPFT is a public radio station. I'm very honored to have with me today a guest calling in all the way from Iowa, Dr. James Lamb, who is the executive director of Lutherans for Life and has been since 1996. In 1994, he received his doctor of ministry from Concordia St. Louis, and prior to accepting the position of executive director of National Lutherans for Life in April of 96, Dr. Lamb served as senior pastor of St. Paul and Garner, Iowa for 14 years. So, Dr. Lamb, I was mentioning this is the first time I've ever done a podcast with a phone interview. Are you there?
I am here.
Okay. And it seems that the computer is recording you, and so I think we're good to go. But I got to know Dr. Lamb because I was very honored to serve on the board for Lutherans for Life for 3 years, and I just have an awful lot of respect for what Lutherans for Life does. Dr. Lamb, could you give us about a short summary of all the things Lutherans for Life does? Obviously, abortion is a big part of that ministry, but Lutherans for Life is involved in a whole range of issues, of life issues.
Oh, yes, most certainly. Abortion being one of those, and in the early days, back in the late 70s, that was the focus of Lutherans for Life, to try to educate Lutherans particularly and help them understand the implications of the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. But since then, the life issues have, there's just certainly more and more life issues to address in our culture today. So Lutherans for Life covers a whole gamut all the way from the beginning of life. We talk about stem cell research, cloning, biotechnology, abortion, but we also have an entire ministry devoted to post-abortion syndrome, the struggles that women and men go through in the aftermath of an abortion decision when that reality sets in.
Yeah,
and we have a whole focus on the younger generation called Why for Life, and we have a lot of materials focused on the end of life. We have a structure, a frontline structure. We have state affiliates and life teams and congregations and chapters. And these folks are indeed out there on the front lines, and they're helping equip Lutherans with materials that we produce, but they're also busy starting or volunteering at pregnancy care centers, really, really doing the work out there.
Yeah,
and we're not a Lutheran Society is not a political group like Right to Life kind of organizations. They're important. Their focus is to change laws, and we need laws to be changed on these issues. But our focus at Lutherans for Life is to change people's hearts and to change people's minds. Yeah. And so, as a Lutheran ministry, we base everything we do then on the life-changing message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so our mission statement is to equip Lutherans to be gospel-motivated voices for life. We want people to be voices for life, but not angry, frustrated, yelling, screaming voices, but reasonable voices motivated by our love for life because of God's love for life.
Absolutely. You know, and as Lutherans, you know, we're careful never to get too angry. We're a relatively sedate people, but no, in all seriousness, that's exactly right. The point is that our Lutheran theology drives us in our understanding of the gospel, drives us to do this work. So I do want to talk about that. And, I can actually already start to envision a whole series of shows around other issues, assisted suicide or euthanasia and things of that nature. But today, because we're early in this podcast, my focus is to basically just look at abortion, generally speaking, not all the complex issues of it, I'm sure, but just to sort of look at it in general for the person who, there was a time when I wasn't sure what I thought about abortion. When I was in college, you know, you hear a lot of different opinions about it. Yes, I was a Christian, but my pastor never mentioned it, so the only time I ever heard it talked about was on political talk radio, actually. So this is a podcast for those who really maybe aren't sure what to think about it or why. So let's start at the very beginning, and let's say, you know, let's make sure that we're talking about the same thing. So when we talk about an abortion, is there a definition for that, a working definition for that that you would use?
Well, I think if we go back to just the word itself, etymology is two Latin words. It means away from the beginning.
Hmm.
So it's the away from the beginning of life. And we talk about abortion, but we need to remember there are two definitions for abortion. I remember a lady taking me aside one time after I spoke, and she said, you know, my medical records say I had an abortion, but what she had is what we commonly refer to as a miscarriage.
Hmm.
But medically, that's called a spontaneous abortion.
Hmm.
And what normally, when people say the word abortion in our culture, they're talking about an induced abortion.
Mm, okay.
And an induced abortion is where you cause the death of that unborn child.
Mm. Yeah, that's an important distinction. As I look at debates on Facebook and so forth, one of the retorts from those in the more pro-choice community will say, for lack of a better word at this point, God must will that some babies do not survive because miscarriages take place, and so it's almost like a justification of abortion in that regard. But but what we're talking about would be an induced abortion where there's been a conception. There's no doubt about whether there's a conception or not. And whatever it is that conception has wrought, which you and I would say is a life, and obviously others either don't give an answer or would not say, you know, would say it's not a life, it would bring that thing to an end. Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, where does the, you know, this is a big question, but where does the sort of heart of the disagreement lie? I think from our point of view, for us, perhaps... you can disagree. I mean, but perhaps the most important question is when does life begin? Because if we can establish that, it seems that we can build an argument from there logically. On the other side, there are concerns about women's freedom and rights to do with their body medically what they feel that they should have the right to do. You also have what seems to happen a lot in these debates is that the pro-life, again, these are vague terms, but the pro-life community is for the baby, and the pro-choice community is for the woman or women. And so where do you think the heart of the disagreement on this issue really lies?
Well, I'll go back to your first two comments, that when does life begin, and then... You know, the right of the woman to choose what are her rights. And I think we need to look at a combination of both of those things to get at the heart of things. you know, we talk about, you know, and Roe v. Wade stated the phrase, you know, no one knows, or no one really knows when life begins, and we hear that a lot out there. But that's not true. It's just that we're asking the wrong people when life begins. And we shouldn't be asking politicians that question. We shouldn't be, certainly shouldn't be asking Hollywood movie stars that question. And pastors aren't really the ones to answer that question either. The ones who can answer that question are the embryologists. They're the ones who work with life at its very beginning. And embryologists, the answer, there's a consensus. I have a list of embryology textbooks used in medical schools in our country, and every single one of them say something like this, that when, at the moment of syngamy, we would use the phrase conception, I guess, when the gametes come together as one, a new and distinct human life has started. So scientifically, if you just look at it scientifically, look at it from the point of view of embryology, at that moment of conception, there is a new and unique human being using the genetic code from dad and the genetic code from mom. Now it's new and distinct. And in fact, it's so distinct. We're the result of a possible 1 in 70 trillion chromosomal combinations. 1 in 70 trillion.
That's so, almost as much as our national debt.
Yeah, not quite. I didn't check this
yeah,
one.
Right.
Yeah. So if you've told your wife lately, you know, she's 1 in a million, Pastor, you can do better than
oh,
that.
Oh, man. Oh, thank
yeah,
you.
She's
thank
1
you.
In 70 trillion.
And, nice.
And so is each and every person listening to this podcast. And they were that distinct human being from that very moment of conception.
There are two ways to talk about that then. So you've talked about the medical, okay, in other words, or the scientific. The other is the philosophical, right?
Yes.
I mean, in terms of, you know, answering this question. So where would we go there?
Well, now we can ask, okay, does a woman have a right to choose? And certainly we would say, well, yes, we all have a right to choose. It's often accompanied with the phrase, a woman has a right to choose to do what she wants with her own body. Just recently, locally here, the Des Moines Register had a little editorial regarding the videos we've been seeing about Planned Parenthood selling body parts. And this gal, she's written for them. I've read her. She seems to be quite a learned gal. But her defense was, for all of this, is that until that baby is born, it's part of the mother's body, and she can do whatever she wants with it. And again, that's simply biologically absurd. It is not part of the mother's body. Everything about the development of the baby is controlled by the baby. Even the hookup mechanism and the placenta and the umbilical cord, the baby produces all of that. Mom is just providing this this wonderful environment in her womb for this new and distinct human being to grow and to develop, and she supplies the nourishment for that, most certainly.
So this author was actually equivocating essentially the baby with, say, the woman's liver.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. And whereas we know genetically that is simply not the case, because the baby now has genetic information from both parents and, as you say, is already functioning independently and some obviously dependent upon the mother, you know, for the womb and for the
sure.
place and the nourishment. No one's denying that, but...
No.
Yeah.
And that baby is going to have dependence on mom after he or she is born, too.
Yeah.
But the point is, if we establish the fact, and we can medically, that this is a new and distinct human being now, then a woman does not have a right to do harm to another human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we have to help people understand. you know, we have a right to do things, but we don't have a right to do wrong things.
Right.
And a woman doesn't have a right to choose to do something that will harm another life. You know, and she doesn't have a right to be drinking alcohol and doing drugs. These will harm her baby.
Yeah.
And she certainly doesn't have a right to end that baby's.
Right. And generally someone who is, again, we'll say pro-choice for lack of a better word. Someone simply say pro-abortion, but someone who is pro-choice would agree with us on all that if we took the baby and removed it from the mother's womb for about a year. Now, actually, you know, more and more pro-abortion advocates are advocating for the termination of life within a certain span after death, or after birth, rather. You know, what is that, a post-birth abortion or something? There's a term for that, but that's a pretty extreme position. But your average pro-choice person would agree with everything that we've said in terms of protecting the child and going to great lengths to protect the child once the child is outside of the womb, even though still totally dependent on the mother for nourishment and for shelter and protection and so forth. What we're saying is that there really is no medical difference between a small embryo or fetus in a womb or baby, we would say, and a baby that has now left the womb. All that we are talking about is a difference in space, but not a difference of kind. Is that simplifying it too much?
I think we need to be simple about it, help people understand that it is really that simple. There's no magic that happens in that 4 inches of the birth canal from when a baby's in the womb and they're outside the womb. They are still a new and unique human being. What we've been talking about, we just have different stages of development and different terminology to call those stages. You know,
yeah.
At conception, we're a zygote, and we become a blastocyst, and an embryo, and after 10 weeks, medically, we're a fetus, and then we're born. We're a baby, we're an infant, we're adolescents, we're mature, we're adults, we're elderly. We have all these labels.
Mm-hmm.
It's just they all are labeling a human being.
Yep. One of the debates I've gotten recently on Facebook, and it was about the Planned Parenthood issue, and so there was some going back and forth, and my argument was, look, I've made a case that abortion is wrong because I believe that life begins at conception. And, you know, it's a very simple case that from there, my understandings about this procedure are guided on the fact that life begins and therefore life is to be protected. And I asked the other person, I said, when would you say that life begins? Because, you know, I've made my case built on my philosophical and now I would say medical understanding. What is your position? And he wrote back something I thought was very interesting. He wrote back, well, most states agree that life begins at 24 weeks. And I'm not familiar with all the different state laws, but I guess what he was saying is that abortion is legal in most states at that stage of development. And it might maybe 24 weeks is not even the right answer. But his point was to argue a legal concept, and what I wanted to know from him was what his moral convictions were, you know, what his commitments were, and how he understood abortion in light of those moral commitments. But the only answer he could give is 24 weeks. So this, for me, that kind of gets into the philosophical question, because, well, what's so special about 24 weeks? You know, what's the difference between 23 weeks and 6 days? And you see, you know, we're going to get into a kind of absurd regression here. Well, what's the difference between 23 weeks and 22 weeks? And what's the difference between 20 weeks and 18 weeks? And we just can trace it all the way back. And do you ever hear pro-choice people give an answer on when life begins? I mean, obviously, there's no consistent answer to that, and states vary on it, so the law varies on it. But, you know, if you press the point that life begins and that something special happens at what we would call conception, you know, without even importing any of our Christian theology about the soul, you know, being paired with this body at conception and so on and so forth, without even going there, do you hear from pro-choice people a coherent or consistent argument from their side about when life begins, or is that a question that just goes unanswered day after day?
Well, I think what this person was perhaps referring to when he talked about states and is that they're called viability laws. And so there are states that will say at 24 weeks, this baby is capable of living outside the womb. And you can push that back to 22 weeks for viability. You know, when can this child survive outside the womb? And so they'll then say that's when life really begins. But that's a counterintuitive argument if you think it through, because even a full-term baby cannot survive by itself outside the womb.
Right.
So again, we're really talking about different stages of human development. And to try to connect when life begins to anything but the biological process of conception, I think then we just start, we can come forth with all kinds of arguments, but you would have yours, I would have mine, this person would have theirs. One state says this, one state says that. It simply becomes a guessing game, or we base it on, you know, viability, as I've said.
Right.
Not really on scientific and genetic facts.
Right. It's just completely arbitrary. And
yeah.
And technology is to the point, obviously, where that age of viability has changed through the years, right?
Yeah.
I don't think we'll ever get to a point where we can have a conception in a laboratory where, you know, the child still needs to be in the womb of a mother, but, you know, the amount of time of incubation in the mother is obviously shrinking. I mean, I don't know what the earliest perhaps a child that had to be born early has been able to survive in an ECU and go on to a healthy life, but I mean, it's pretty early, right?
Yes, I've heard of 22 weeks is
wow.
The youngest I've heard.
Okay.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, that is. You know, again, if people have watched any of the Planned Parenthood videos, and they're extremely troubling to watch, I'm sure some of those babies were probably around 22 to 24 weeks.
Yeah.
Based on the Lutherans for Life models that are available at conferences everywhere. The little what are those made of? The little rubber babies?
They're actually made with a biosynthetic skin.
Oh,
so they feel like we felt. They're very, very lifelike. And the only thing we can't replicate, of course, is that we're surrounded by the amniotic fluid, so we're wet, kind of slimy. But still, we have this very soft, we're very palatable because bones haven't hardened and there's a lot of cartilage. And so you hold these models are the same weight that we were at that stage, and even the texture. And that's why these models, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but they come with a little jar of baby powder.
Mm.
And the reason for that is not just to make them smell like babies, but the oil from our skin will kind of break down their skin. They'll get sticky after they're being touched. And so every once in a while you have to powder
for
your babies.
And for people who don't know, essentially anywhere, you know, of course I go to Lutheran conferences, and Lutherans for Life fortunately is always there. They weren't always invited in my past denomination, but in my current denomination they are always given a good table space to present their materials. And one thing they always have is it's a little kind of a cardboard box, almost like a couple of shoe boxes big, right? And within it is kind of a lovely display of these models, which show different stages of development. And what is the earliest and what is the largest?
We have the smallest one in that set is 12 weeks.
Okay.
And then the largest one is 28.
Okay. And so you can actually pick up and see this is what a baby looks like at 12 weeks of development. And you see there are hands, there are toes, there are, and of course we could see within the body, we would see beating hearts, we would see functioning organs, we would see, there would be a brain, there are eyes, there's a nose, there's a mouth, you know, it's...
all of that is, and in fact, at eight weeks after conception, we're pretty much all there. All our parts.
Mm.
They just need to develop, get bigger, of course, and be able to function better. But they're pretty much all there.
Yeah.
At 8 weeks, and
And there is a special ministry that you have related to those models, and I do want to get to that later, so don't let me forget, okay?
All right.
Because
I wanted to point out something that I find, I think it's revealing. We have this, they're called Touch of Life fetal models, and as you said, we have these often on our displays. And when little kids walk by, they don't say, oh, look at the embryos, or look at the fetuses. They say, look at the babies. They recognize
they get it.
That's a baby.
Yeah. One other question about development, and I want to make sure this number is right. It almost seems hard to believe, but does the heart begin to beat? And we recognize, you know, I don't know how developed this heart would be with, you know, various, I don't even know, is it ventricles and aortas that hearts have? I think that's right. But what time, at one point could we see in the progress or the development of a baby, something start to beat?
Well, very early, actually. Around 18 to 20 days, 18 to 20 days, mom may not even know she's pregnant yet. But we got to be careful. Even those in a pro-life side will tell you, your heart starts beating then. Well, in a sense, the heart tissue actually beats. So there's a rhythm to heart tissue, and that starts really early. And does that mean we have a functioning heart that's actually pumping blood? Not quite at that point, but that happens very, very quickly, and very soon. Able to even hear that heartbeat on a monitor or with a stethoscope.
Heart
tissue begins to beat very early.
Yeah,
and most abortions are around 10 weeks, and so the little slogan "abortion stops a beating heart" is absolutely true.
Yeah, that's why. You know, what's amazing about that then is that before a woman may even know she's pregnant, because usually in an unexpected pregnancy situation, you know, it's when a woman, you know, obviously misses her period that she finds out that, wait, I'm you know, I might be pregnant here. And by that point, you know, there's a very good chance then that heart tissue is already in movement, you know, is already beating. And that's a really remarkable thing to think about, because even those who would say things like, well, I'm okay with first trimester, and usually, you know, these things get cut off at trimesters. You know, I'm okay with first trimester abortions, but after that, you know, it's a problem. And what we would say is, well, wait a minute, all of our body parts are there at 8 weeks. That's now firmly within the first trimester, and even well before that, you've got this flesh that is already starting to beat. So there's also an interesting scene from the movie Juno. Have you ever seen that?
I have, yes.
And it's not exactly a pro-life movie. I mean, it's certainly not a Christian movie. But Ellen Page was kind of made the rounds, because she went up to Ted Cruz at the Iowa State Fair or something, where he was grilling pork, and she grilled him about gay marriage. And there was an interesting back and forth that I don't know if it went viral, but it kind of got out there. But she plays a young woman who gets unexpectedly pregnant, and she goes to the abortion clinic. And one of her friends is outside, and I can't remember what she says, but it's something like the baby has fingerprints or fingernails at...
Fingernails, she says.
Okay.
Yeah. All she says is, your baby has fingernails.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad you've seen that, yeah. And that was kind of the thing that changed her mind, right? Like, wait a minute.
Yes, it was.
You know, fingernail, because that is something, that is the human touch that we can relate to. You know, now this thing goes from... some tissue to something remarkably like us, you know, with something as ordinary as fingernails, you know? And it seems like if people could understand that is what is in the body of this woman, that something like abortion would actually be unconscionable. I mean, putting aside debates, I mean, there really wouldn't be a debate at that point, because if someone could understand that is what is actually in the body of that woman, that the other issues are, while some are very important, the health of the mother, and we can get to things like that as well. But, you know, some of those things, yes, they're very important, and the health of the mother is the most complicated issue that we would have to deal with. But the rights of the mother, I think, at that point, if that is a viable human person inside of the woman, you know, the debate gets, at the very least, the debate gets a lot more, I don't know. From my point of view, well, it gets a lot more one-sided, but...
Yeah, well, it does, because, see, we started out with this word abortion, and it's just become so commonplace. We talk about abortion, and we use the word, but we use it almost like it's a, you know, just another medical procedure, and we forget what it is and what it does, and that there's this tiny little human being that is destroyed, and there is this great disconnect that we're just discussing it, you know, between a baby who is born, and that's a baby, and we care for them, and we protect them, we do all kinds of things to preserve their lives, but prior to birth, somehow we don't visualize, understand what that really is, and that's why I think there are two things. The videos that we're seeing, people are becoming more aware of what abortion really is and what it does. But ultrasound supports what you were just saying, because abortion-minded women, between 80 and 90% of these abortion-minded women, if they see their baby on an ultrasound, will change their mind.
Mm.
So it's helping them see that reality, or you know, they're able to hear that little heartbeat inside of them. I saw an incredible ultrasound the other day. One of the privileges I have is travel around. I get to tour pregnancy centers. Mm. And one of the great things so many of our centers do is offer free ultrasounds. And they showed me the ultrasound. It was recorded. It wasn't live. But this abortion-minded woman, and they had a big screen TV up on the wall. It's not some little monitor they're looking at. And the first image she saw was her 10-week unborn baby with his little hand was up in the air like he was waving at her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, changed her mind.
10 weeks. Wow, that is a tiny, tiny, tiny baby at that point still. But,
yes.
But you get the you get the sense of the, already there is an arm and fingers, you know? The seeing these fingers that small is just remarkable. You know, it's interesting, too. We live in a world where, you know, there are all of these abortions every year, you know, some over 1 million a year, I think, at this point. Is that about right?
And about 1.2.
And Planned Parenthood is about a fourth of that, right? So, did you hear me? Planned Parenthood is like a fourth of that.
Sorry. They do. They're the largest abortion provider.
Okay. But, you know, and of course they lobby against, they work hard to prevent those very sonograms. But what's amazing is that we have that many abortions going on in our nation. And yet at the same time, we have all of this technological development where, you know, of course, there have been 4D sonograms for a number of years. So, you know, we have a video of my daughter in my wife's womb. As a 4D sonogram, and they call it 4D because it's not a two-dimensional image, it's a three-dimensional image, where I guess they use the sound to create an image that is more 3D, and then of course they offer you sound of what's going on in the womb as well. So
Movement, and it's a little video.
You see it happening, and it's and you know, people get these things, and the first thing they do is put it on Facebook. You know, I mean, they want to share it with the world. Hey, look at what's going on inside my body. Look at my baby. And on the other hand, we have a society that is so almost schizophrenic that we commit 1.2 million abortions. It's strange. It's also strange the way that when a celebrity or the princess in England is pregnant, it's just worldwide news. You know, so-and-so is going to have a baby. This actress that's been trying to have a baby is now married and is going to have a baby. Or Kim Kardashian has a child and she's pregnant again. It's like this such big news. And on the other hand, abortion after abortion after abortion. And other than cranky people like you and me, you know, it's just no one hears about it. It's so bizarre sometimes, the schizophrenia. No offense to schizophrenics, you know, the kind of society we have. But let me ask you this. One of the things that people assume is that those in the pro-life, again, not the best phrase, but the pro-life community are basically against women. You know, we're misogynist in some way. We don't believe in women's freedom. What would we say in response to someone who says, you know, essentially that we are in some way against women?
Well, it's just the opposite of that. We are we are for women, I think, more than people who say that the best way to deal with an unplanned pregnancy or a crisis pregnancy of some sort is to kill your child. And the psychological damage we know now that happens to men and women in the aftermath of an abortion, that just brings great harm to women. And folks who are for life and life affirming, we affirm not just the life of that child, but the life of that mom too, and we want to do what's best for both of them. And we know that what's best for a woman is not to have her child murdered through abortion. That is something that is just merely impossible to deal with when that reality strikes.
Yeah.
And so life-affirming groups, you know, the pregnancy centers on the front lines that I mentioned earlier, they're not just out there to save babies. They're out there to save and nurture families.
Hmm.
All of these centers that I've ever been to, you know, they have classes that teach these moms about cooking skills and finances, and if dad's on the scene, to bring him in, and parenting skills. There are places where women can stay while they're pregnant and deliver their baby and can stay there sometimes up to 2 years afterwards. They have babysitters who come in so mom can go to school, drivers to take her to school or to doctor's appointments if she's not able. I mean, we can just go on and on and on. The things that the pro-life community does for women is incredible.
Yeah, and we do know now that there is... you know, is there a diagnosis or a name for post-abortive, you know, regret or something along the line? I mean, it might be akin in some cases to PTSD or something like that.
It is exactly that. Yeah.
Okay.
Post-abortion syndrome is the same. It's a reaction to a traumatic event in your life, and the symptoms are very, very much the same.
Yeah. And so I do want to mention this ministry because I do think it's vitally important. And while I was on the board, it became officially within the kind of circle of Lutherans for Life, which is Word of Hope.
Yes.
And so it does offer post-abortive, you know, counseling for women. I do want to tell one story that can I give the executive director's name of Word for Hope?
Yes, Grace Kern.
Yeah, Grace Kern. So I remember a story that she told to the board, and I've never forgotten it. I never will. And it was a story where she, you know, basically she operates a ministry where people can call in and get counseling, and in the wake of an abortion, and she gets calls from people of all ages and from men as well, because men do have regrets about pushing perhaps their girlfriend or wives into an abortion and so forth. But one call was from an elderly woman who called to express regret about an abortion that she had many years before, and it was a secret for a long time. And they talked, and they went through the conversation as usual. And a few days later, Grace gets the same call from the same woman and repeats the same thing as though the previous conversation had never happened. And essentially what Ms. Kern realized was that this woman had Alzheimer's or dementia, and she was trapped within this world of regret. And at that point, her mind had no real way out of it, because even if she had been, for example, had pronounced forgiveness had been pronounced over her, she wouldn't remember it. And so it was an example not only of the toll that abortion can take on a woman in the immediate aftermath or in the years afterwards, but in the case of this woman, and I grant this is a bit of an extreme case, but this woman couldn't escape it. It was literally a regret that she would have forever, because her mind was now not capable of processing forgiveness in the wake of it or any kind of reconciliation with it. And I just pitied that poor woman who would essentially be tortured by this memory and this regret, and there was no way out. But and again, that's kind of an extreme example, but I'm sure that Grace deals with this sort of regret all the time.
Yes, we do get calls from nursing homes, women in the latter stages of their lives, they've yet to deal with this great trauma. And I think there's one thing we should point out, in case there are folks listening who say, well, you know, I've had an abortion and I don't regret it, or I know someone and they don't seem to have regret their abortion, is that the reality, that this is amazing to me, but I learned this from Grace, the reality of an abortion and what that really did, the destruction of your own child, the average time for that to hit is 9 years after the abortion.
Wow.
So, you know, it's such an unnatural act that defense mechanisms pop up right away. Mm. And by far, the initial feeling for most women is relief.
Mm.
The problem is solved. Now I can get back to my life again, mm-hmm. my normal life again. But sooner or later, they realize that they can't, and they hadn't then. And it will start to manifest itself in other ways: drug abuse, alcohol abuse, depression, mm-hmm. suicidal thoughts, suicidal attempts. The latter about 5 times greater in post-abortive women than the normal population.
Mm. Wow.
And marital difficulties. You know, a pastor might be dealing with a couple and they're struggling in their marriage, and neither of them realize it's because of an abortion that happened.
Mm.
It just gets buried so deeply.
Yeah.
There are trigger events that, you know, like the day the child should have been born, or Mother's Day, or Life Sunday in a church,
mm-hmm.
can trigger thoughts. I remember one woman who shared that she was vacuuming her living room and she just broke down in tears on her couch. She didn't know why she was crying. Well, it turns out that vacuum brings back the memories of the suction aspirator used in early abortion.
Oh, wow.
And it just triggers these things.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
so
and
it takes a while for that to hit.
Yeah.
Can we give that number out, our Word of Hope number?
Absolutely. If you have it handy, please.
I do. It's 888-217-8679.
Yeah.
888-217-8679.
Thank you.
You'll receive a professional counseling there, confidential, someone who really, really cares for those who are hurting.
Absolutely. You know, our church is located across the street from a community college, and there have been a couple of occasions for talking through regretted abortions and also talking through unexpected pregnancies and the importance of not carrying through the abortion. And yes, there's no doubt that I've seen, as well as I'm sure you've seen many more times, but the power that an abortion can have over a person. And, you know, that does get both of us, I think, to the gospel. And there's so much more that we could talk about. But, you know, we're both pastors, we're both Lutherans. And, you know, as heinous as abortion is, and as clear as you and I believe it is, which is the ending of a life, that does not mean, with all of the harsh words that people believe that we have spoken today, that does not mean that there is no way out. Okay, there is in fact a word from God on this moral issue, and I wanted to just say as well that from your and I points of view, this is a moral issue. Yes, it's also a political issue, but first and foremost, it's a moral issue, and that's why the church has standing on this issue and can speak on this issue.
I would say, first and foremost, it's a spiritual issue that has been politicized and moralized. But for us, it's a spiritual issue because we're not just talking about the destruction of life, but we know the author of life. And so these children, from our perspective, they're the work of his hands. You know, knit together in the womb, God's word says.
Yeah.
And Jesus Christ has shed his blood for those babies. But as we've been alluding to here, he shed his blood for the moms and dads involved in that decision as well. And there most certainly is a word of hope and a way out in him.
So in addition to maybe talking to a counselor or something, you know, one of the things that I've always advised people is, in our tradition, we do have a right for individual confession and forgiveness. It's not only Roman Catholics that have that, but I'm sure within most church bodies there is a way of going to a pastor and saying this thing out loud to a spiritual leader or a spiritual advisor and hearing a word of forgiveness. Because what Jesus did on the cross was truly for everybody, for every sin, and simply what we would say is take that to the cross, take it to the Lord, and there is forgiveness. There is no sin that is beyond the reach of the cross. There is no sin that is beyond forgiveness, even though we are very passionate about when life begins and that it is wrong to end a pregnancy. You know, we want to say very clearly here today that if you do have regrets about an abortion, that you can talk to a pastor, a Christian pastor, who can bring you that word of forgiveness.
Absolutely. And again, if you call our Word of Hope hotline, Grace can put you in touch with Christian counseling in your area as well. So it's not just something you have to do over the phone, but she'll hook you up with people who really, really care. They're not going to be judgmental. They're going to be compassionate.
Yeah. Let me ask a couple more questions, and then I think we're just about out of time. But one of the things, you know, I'm going to read you a couple of quotes, basically, that you know, I mean, I think we've established our principles in terms of when life begins and the fact that there is hope after an abortion. And, you know, we've, I think, in short form here, established why we would view abortion as a spiritual and a moral failing, even still, you know, with there being hope. But one of the things that I hear from people who advocate choice is really, you know, an abortion is a way to avoid a life of discomfort or suffering for the child. And so what I want to do is read you a couple of quotes, because I think these are maybe even more nuanced, or they're different kinds of arguments in favor of abortion. It, you know, it really avoids the question of when life begins and do we have a duty to protect the baby in the womb. It circumvents all of that. And so one of the things that I've heard recently, and these are all direct quotes, although I'm not going to give names. There were folks commenting on Facebook and so forth. But one quote is, "We know that the most effective anti-abortion strategy involves lifting women and children out of poverty." So in other words, what they're saying is, if we can promise almost a utopian existence for all people, then no one would ever want to get an abortion. Now, that utopian existence is impossible in a world of sin, but putting that aside, what would you say to somebody who says, well, look, you know, are you suggesting that it's good for children to be born into poverty and to not have all the advantages of life?
Well, I think that quote, there's a false premise there, don't you think? That I think they're making the assumption that most women have abortions because they're poor. And if we could somehow stop poverty, we'd stop abortion.
Yeah.
But see, that premise is wrong. 42% of abortions, according to the Alan Guttmacher website, they're kind of the research arm of Planned Parenthood, so I usually use their statistics so no one can challenge me of being biased. But they say that 42% of women who have abortion are under the poverty line.
Mm.
But there are So there's a large chunk, yes, certainly. But there are other reasons why women have abortions. It's going to interfere with their schooling, their career, their future. They're having problems with their spouse or their partner. There are a whole host of reasons why women give for having an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Poverty is one of those, but it's certainly not exclusive.
Yeah, there might be shame in the family if you're pregnant out of wedlock or something.
Right, yeah. Right. And I think the other point is what kind of culture are we living in if we think that killing our children is the way to solve poverty?
Right.
To me, that's a form of poverty, moral poverty right there.
Yeah,
and we don't, you know, back to this disco, we don't think that way, do we, of born children? I mean, let's just, a scenario, family, they have four kids, and everything is going along well, and then mom gets cancer, and dad loses his job, and now finances are really tight, so...
Can't afford the kids anymore.
Let's kill a couple of the kids. Maybe the teenagers. They're more expensive.
Oh, man.
Now, you know, people might be enraged at hearing that just now. And yet, that's how enraged we can be in the struggle we have, because there's really no difference in destroying a human being after they're born and before they're born.
Yeah.
Just because we don't think we can afford them.
Yeah. I just think it's a
false argument.
Yeah. Let me give another argument, and this deals more with the concept of safety, okay? So we move kind of from money situations to safety. And this is another direct quote. I took it straight out of a Facebook comment. So I think it's representative, in other words, of the sorts of things that, you know, people say and think about this. Said, I've heard enough stories of back alley abortions that I think banning the practice is dangerous to people who will make that choice anyway. Now, I have never heard a story of a back alley abortion. I didn't even know they existed anymore. I don't know why they would. So maybe if they're speaking to someone pre-1970s who engaged in a back alley abortion is such a loaded visual image too. I really regret that phrase. But essentially, what they're saying is, hey, you know, what we have, it may not be great, but at least, you know, it's safe. People can go into a clean medical environment. And it's better that than, you know, the guy in the alley who's going to perform an abortion. What would we say to that?
Well, first of all, again, there's some false data that's based upon. And that was the data floated prior to 1973 to make people really believe that women were dying left and right from these so-called back alley abortions of, you know, people doing abortions who didn't have medical degrees, or they did, but they didn't have the sanitary conditions and all of that. And so there were numbers like, you know, 2,000 a year were dying from back alley abortions. And one of the people who were to help float those numbers was Dr. Bernard Nathanson, who had performed thousands and thousands of abortions. He later on became a Christian and renounced all that he had done, and admitted that he was one of those who helped float those false numbers. So the amount of back alley abortions happening was a false premise in the beginning.
Yeah.
So, but here's something else to think about is, okay, so we have people doing abortions who shouldn't be not licensed, but now we make abortion after Roe v. Wade essentially legal.
Mm-hmm.
Where do these back alley abortionists come to? They come out to Front Street. There are still people, physicians who do abortions are not always looked upon with great favor in the medical community.
Mm-hmm.
So. We still have the kind of non-sanitary conditions often happening. One name comes to mind, and that would be Hermit Gosnell. That made public news. Maybe people listening heard some of the horrible things that were happening and the horrible sanitary conditions in his clinic. I hate to use that word.
Right. No, but if there was ever the image of back alley abortion, that is the guy that comes to mind. And he did it in a place where there was abortion completely legal and rampant in a big city. You know, he wasn't out in the middle of nowhere where he was the only guy within a 100-mile radius who would perform such a procedure. He's in the middle of Philadelphia, and it was as ghastly as you could possibly imagine. I mean, I've seen horror movies that are tame by comparison, so.
I know. And, you know, I have a dog, and my veterinary clinic has to follow more regulations than some of these abortion mills do. And groups like Planned Parenthood and others, when a state is considering abortion mill regulations, they just oppose them. They fight them tooth and nail.
Yeah, and in Texas, of course, you know, there's so many fewer abortion places because laws creatively, and I think by state legislatures, are getting very creative about this.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of saying, look, if you're an abortion clinic, you have to have hospital privileges, which essentially means that if something goes wrong, you can admit quickly. I mean, you're pre-approved for admittance into a hospital to treat a patient, right? I mean, and that's one of the more creative, I think, laws, and that puts a lot of abortion clinics out of business because they don't have hospital admittance privileges because they haven't gone through whatever steps are necessary to prove that they're a bona fide medical clinic. So even though there may be a doctor in place actually performing the operation, if they don't have admittance privileges or, you know, I'm not sure of the technicalities of it, but, you know, the point is that we're states are saying you're not just allowed to open up a shop and do whatever you want. You're going to have admittance privileges to a hospital. You're going to have to have certain, you're going to have certain cleanliness standards or whatever. And I think that's why in Texas, for example, we've seen so many fewer abortion clinics. Now, I live about a mile from the Planned Parenthood Center in Houston, which is, I think used to be a bank building or something. And it's, you know, 5-6 stories of...
Yeah, I've been there. I've seen that.
Yeah. So you know, certainly they have the ability to perform many abortions in a large place. But let me ask, too, because people always want to know this, and we're in a season of political debate, which happens, I guess, about every 4 years. But, you know, people are asked about their stance on abortion, and specifically, you know, within, say, the Republican world, Republicans tend to be on the pro-life side of things, but then there are questions about the safety of the mother or maybe even the viability of the baby. And one quote that also came up on Facebook is regarding Downs or CF. I should know what CF is, but...
Cystic fibrosis.
Oh, okay, thank you. Okay. So essentially that person's arguing, hey, look, you know, if someone finds out they have Down syndrome child or a child with cystic fibrosis, they, you know, they commit an abortion, and that seems pretty reasonable. But what do we do in the harder cases where a life of the mother is at stake? And a choice has to be made, a dreadful choice, or if a child has unique challenges in terms of a physical or a mental disability?
Well, essentially, you know, if I say it this way, again, it might sound crass, but we're saying that we should be able to kill children for their own good.
Yeah.
And that's... We don't talk that way. If a child, a perfectly, we would say, normal child falls and gets a brain injury, now that child is going to be more dependent and not be able to function as well as before. We don't offer, at least at this point, we don't offer one of the solutions is to take the life of that child. Although in other countries, that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So we're called upon to care for moms who are pregnant with children who may have some sort of disability, even severe, called upon to care for them and their child and provide care and compassion and help after that child is to be born. You know, I know and have worked with, as a pastor and as director of Lutherans for Life, many, many families who have very severe children with very severe disabilities. And yeah, it's a struggle. It's hard. And it requires sacrifice. And sometimes you feel like quitting and all those things. But there's a common phrase I always hear. I have yet to not hear it. And that is, yeah, you know, little Johnny, he's a lot of work and sacrifice, but he is such a blessing to us and to so many others.
Yeah.
And so any child, every child, is and can be a blessing to other people. And when we have children that provide extra care, see, that gives us a reason and someone to care for. And this is where, you know, Christian congregations can really be called forth to help in those kinds of situations.
Yeah.
And then back to the life of the mother idea, first of all, it's very, very rare that an abortion will be needed to save the physical life of the mother. You know, there are things like the prime example is an ectopic pregnancy where the baby implants in the fallopian tube rather than getting to the womb, to the uterus. And although we're getting closer to, in my understanding, being able to deal with that surgically, But right now, both mom and baby are going to die if that pregnancy continues there.
Right.
And so the solution for an ectopic pregnancy is to remove the fallopian tube.
Hmm.
So the baby dies, but you didn't go in to kill the baby to save the mother's life.
Mm-hmm.
You went in, you removed the fallopian tube to save the mother's life, and as a result of that, the life of the baby is lost as well.
Yeah, and that is what we would call a classic moral dilemma. And
yes.
You know, there are always going to be situations where there is essentially a no-win proposition, and we choose the greater of two goods or the lesser of two evils, depending on how you would want to look at it. But I don't think those questions are always very fair. I think what we want to know is, in normal circumstances, because, you know, we understand that within the world of morals and within the world of the law, there are always going to be exceptions. The question is, do we base an entire law...
Yes.
Regarding abortion on a very rare case of when a woman's life is actually in danger. And that seems to me to be quite silly to do, and yet, and I don't think actually we do that. I think that's just an excuse. I think what this society actually wants is complete autonomy over their own bodies, over their own minds, over their own desires to do what they want without natural consequences. And to make the case for that, because abortion is essentially a necessary corrective to the sexual freedom that we want, because pregnancy often results in that sort of sexual freedom and autonomy,
mm-hmm.
Then the excuse given is, well, what about the life of a mother? Well, okay, that's a moral dilemma, and we take it on when we need to take it on, but that strikes me, honestly, as an excuse to justify wanting an abortion. But Dr. Lamb, you've been very generous with your time. There's only one more thing I want you to talk about, which is Owen's mission. This was just getting going when my time on the board there at LFL came to an end, but please tell us about Owen's mission.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. Owen's mission was named after our grandson, Owen James Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Owen died during fetal surgery at 21 weeks.
Mm.
And he had this large tumor growing from his coccyx, and so they actually removed him from the womb and tried to remove that tumor, but he just lost so much blood that his little heart stopped.
Mm.
And I was at the hospital and with my son and daughter-in-law, and as we were waiting for our daughter-in-law, Heather, to come back to the recovery room, they brought little Owen's body to us, and my son held him for a while, and I was able to hold him. He was wrapped in one of those little receiving blankets. And, I just unwrapped him a bit. I just wanted to look at him. And, you know, I've held those fetal models we were talking about. There's a 21-week one there. I've held that over the years, you know, hundreds of times.
Mm-hmm.
But little Owen helped remind me that those are not just dolls or models. They represent real little tiny human beings. And Owen was just a little perfect little baby with little skinny arms and long fingers. I think he'd have been a pianist, actually. His fingers were still very long.
Mm.
Anyway, Owen, my family and I wanted to remember Owen and honor the Lord of Life. So we partnered with Lutherans for Life to establish Owen's mission. And the goal of Owen's mission is to place a set of these Touch of Life fetal models into every Lutheran elementary and high school in the country. And you know, we're Lutherans for Life, so we're focusing on Lutheran schools to place these models in. And that's well over 1,000 schools, about 140,000 students, and that's a $175,000 project.
Mm.
So we've been moving along pretty well since you were on the board, Evan, and we're about to 10% of our goal at this point in terms of numbers of students reached and schools reached, and we're just over 100,000 has been raised towards that $175,000 goal.
Mm.
So God's blessing that mission, and the stories we hear, the difference that makes, the impact that it has on children. I mean, we can do a lot. We talked about the reality of the unborn, and you don't have to look at aborted baby parts to see that. Well, you can hold these babies in your hand, and that's a positive way to help children, young people understand the reality of life in the womb. And when we grasp that reality, then I think more and more, as you mentioned earlier, abortion would just become unthinkable. And we'll look for other ways to deal with a problem, crisis pregnancy.
So long as it's an abstract, it somehow is tolerable. But I think these models really help us to see what is going on. So, well, Dr. Lamb, I want to sincerely thank you for your wisdom and your time. This has been your life's calling. There's no doubt about that. And I want to make sure that people know, if you know, because people always want to know what to do. Well, there are things you could do at local pregnancy centers. You can volunteer at local pregnancy centers. You can go to Lutherans for Life website for sure. They have just an enormous amount of resources so that this can be taught to families, to churches, to community groups, anywhere. And it's on all the range of life issues. So we just touched on a very big one today, and we didn't even cover all the issues. But that website is LutheransForLife.org, LutheransForLife.org, LutheransForLife.org. So if people want to learn more, that is the place they would, I think, go to start to learn more. And a word of hope can be found within that website. We reference that as well. So Dr. Lan, I just want to thank you again for your time, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
Yes, you're very welcome. I've enjoyed this. I pray it will be beneficial to folks who are listening, and maybe raise some questions and get folks to think about these issues reasonably and logically, and maybe spiritually as well.
Certainly hope for that. And again, the way to contact the radio station here where the podcast is recorded is kpft.org. If you want to email me about this episode or anything else you've heard anywhere along the way, you just do that at emc2@felchouston.org. And folks, until then, might you have the peace that passes all understanding. God bless.
Out of my head is a ringing spines attack.